Hey, men, ladies, if there's any of you listening along, I'd like to welcome you all to another episode of the Morningstar Men's Weekly Podcast. We record this every Saturday morning from our Saturday Bible study. This week, we're back in the final 2 weeks in the Manly Men series that we've been doing, looking at Stephen Mansfield's book. We have cherry-picked some of the best chapters, we felt, and used them as simply a little bit of a background for study. As you will hear this morning, or when you listen to this, if you follow along with the book, we're just using the basic topic and a few of the points from the chapter, and then we're building it out with some scripture and some other ideas. So our topic for the morning is that of suffering. Suffering isn't a pleasant topic to talk about. I'm sure if we could avoid it, we'd all like to. But it's kind of like, dealing with the realities of estate planning or something. Nobody wants to do it, but you're really smart if you prepare for it in advance. And I think that's the way it would be best to look at suffering. At some point in every individual's life, to one degree or another, we're all going to experience a season of suffering. And I don't mean just a day. I mean a season of suffering. So wouldn't it be best, given that that's probably an eventuality for almost every human being, wouldn't it be best if we prepared for that? So that's what we're going to be looking at this morning. You might want to pause this or get ready to take a few notes. We're going to use a lot of scripture this morning, and the reason that I'm saying pause it, maybe you want to get something so you can jot down some scriptures and look them up later on your own. I think you'll find them to be helpful. You know, sometimes when you read through scripture and you're a little bit fuzzy in the morning or whatever, and you're just trying to get a little bit of the word into you, but it just doesn't come alive. Sometimes when a guy like myself has to invest a lot of time in preparing for something, we try to bore deep into it. We're fresh when we look at it. And so maybe you'll appreciate some new insights or understandings that you'll get as a result of listening to the scripture unpacked a little bit for the morning. Anyway, before I leave this introduction, I want to remind you of the upcoming men's breakfast. Every year, we do a breakfast in the bitter cold of winter. This time it's going to be the 31st of January. We're going to start at 8:30 in the morning. If you're not already signed up, you can go to the Morningstar website, mstarqtown.org. Get yourself signed up. It's $10 for an adult. It's $5 for a guest or a student. That $5 price allows you to invite a few friends along and use this as an opportunity to introduce some people to the life-transforming message that Jesus has to offer. I'd encourage you to do that. All right, guys, I hope this podcast is a blessing to you, and I will catch up with you again next week. Okay. Well, then I guess we're done for that. Our topic for the morning, we've got 2 weeks to go in the Manly Man series. Our topic for the morning, suffering. How many of you read the chapter? We'll at least briefly look at the ideas of expressed in the chapter. For the most part, we're going to go off the reservation. We're going to look at some other ideas. So the first thing I thought we should do is sort of get our heads around the idea of what is suffering. I mean, if you're 14, what does suffering look like to you? Right, no cell phone. The power goes out, and your television doesn't work, or the iPod is, or iPad is low on battery, and there's nowhere to charge it. That's suffering.
It's an eternity until you have a driver's license.
Okay, it's no driver's license. I think most of us have come to the point in life where we realize that suffering is not that. That perhaps it goes a little bit deeper. But the question is, honestly, what is suffering? Because you and I might define suffering differently than, let's say, a Jew during the Holocaust. We might define suffering a little bit different than someone who's fleeing across the border into Syria to avoid ISIS right now. We have a whole different understanding of suffering, so let's get our heads around the idea of exactly what suffering is. Does everyone have a handout? You do not. I think I took. Does anybody else want a handout? If you're suffering, maybe y'all need a handout. Okay, so 11 points that I listed here, they're sort of interconnected. It's a degree of hardship or pain that is beyond the normal and expected. So that's the first level. So it's not I hit my thumb with the hammer while I was trying to mount a picture hanger for my wife. That goes beyond that. It's not the predictable and normal. We're talking about things that come upon you that are beyond the scope of every day. It takes a person near to the edge of his tenacity, endurance, understanding, and coping abilities. In other words, suffering is going to be dependent on the individual. What is your ability to bear up under? Okay, most of us here are at least 40, I'll say. Few not yet. How many of you have a different level of tenacity or coping today than you did 20 years ago? Okay, so your threshold beyond which something becomes suffering is obviously going to change over time. But suppose you've never encountered anything of a particular type before. And you know that people have, you know that other people have gone through this, but you've never gone through it. And so it hits you by surprise. So suffering is very unique and specific to an individual. Okay, so point number three, physical, emotional, personal identity, family security. We have a variety of pain points. Is there something that you're going through right now that you would consider above the norm? Now, let's take all of these. Remember, we have to put all of them together. We'll jump down to number five. This is one of the most troubling. There's no clearly established ending point to the suffering. See, if you knew that whatever you're dealing with would be over in 24 hours, it wouldn't be bad. If you knew it would be over in a year, that would take a different level of mental equipping, but you could say, all right, for this year it's going to be tough, but at the end of this year, 366 days from today, it's going to be good. You'd know how long you had to run. What is this, a sprint? Is it a marathon? But whatever, you'd know. But suffering, in the most case, doesn't have a clearly defined ending point. And that's where you start to feel, well, what do you feel? Something that is beyond anything you've ever experienced in a bad way comes into your life. You're not sure how to cope with it because you've never had to cope with anything like this before, and you're not sure when or even if it's going to end. What starts to settle in? Numb. Any other feelings?
Despair.
Well, I was going to say hopelessness. Fear, maybe. This is where, incidentally, your mind, we're all creative, right? Some of us are creative in good ways, some of us are creative in bad ways. How many of us have worked out scenarios in our own mind about the worst that was going to happen? Living in the street, right? Living under a bridge somewhere in an appliance box. Your wife leaves you, your kids abandon you. Right? I mean, our minds are really creative vessels that will conjure up all sorts of things. All right, here's another one, number seven. It's a type of pain or hardship that seems without merit or benefit. What's one of the questions, the universal questions of suffering?
Why?
Why? Yes, why? Why is this happening? Why is it happening to me? Followed closely by, what's another one of those? Go ahead.
Why not someone else?
Yeah, why not someone else? Or, did I do something to deserve this? Did I bring this on myself? At which point we start to do this balancing thing where we put all the people of the universe on this balancing scale and we say, well, if someone deserved suffering, who should it be? And so we have to come to another point of evaluation on suffering. It probably isn't on there. Suffering is not something that you earn. Suffering is not something that inherently comes to people who deserve it. Suffering can come to people who seem the least likely candidates to deserve suffering. All right. By doing it and becoming it appears that to rob the person of pleasantness and usefulness. Remember, we said that suffering appears to be without benefit. One of the side effects of suffering is that if you had good work to do, if you had a purpose in life, it seems to attack the very purpose and reason for your being. Isn't this one of the questions that believers have? Why, God, why is this happening to me? I'm out here doing this good stuff. And as a matter of fact, very often suffering attacks you at the point where you feel you are doing the most good and having the most effect in life. How could a just God, how could a good God allow this bad thing to come into my life at this very point where I seem to be having the most positive effect for the kingdom of heaven? God, this is really messed up. So what's another one of the side effects of suffering? Just based on what I've described there. What do you see might happen in your own mind?
Question your faith.
Question the object of your faith. Who's your faith in? Your faith is in God. What kind of a God allows this? Can I even trust this God anymore? Let me just jump ahead for a moment. And then we'll return to the list. This is all in the head. This is all in the mind. Most of what we're going to look at today is a battle of the mind. It's either won or lost in the mind. Point number 10, at some point, even life itself begins to seem pointless and beyond the trouble to live. For those of you who read the book, do you recall reading Abraham Lincoln's poem as he contemplated putting an end to his life? And he actually described this knife. You would almost say that he was having a love affair with this knife that he was toying with using to pierce himself through. And it was like it was his mistress, and he was fascinated with it. And this one thing could bring an end to all of the misery that he was experiencing. Suffering is made worse because it is at such points that we are most aware that life isn't fair. At what point in your life did you discover that life wasn't fair? Okay. Well, for most of us, it's not quite five. Did somebody take your candy bar in kindergarten or what?
Boston Green Government.
Oh, that's what it was. Jason, this is why you're over here. You're not over here because you chose to left. They kicked you out.
Jason's still smiling. Look at
him. And so if you look at this next paragraph midway down here, and we can read this together. Life seems to hand some people a pass from pain for a while. It even hands some people what appears to be a winning lottery ticket. They're born with or fall into the right situations and opportunities, and with a reasonable amount of work, they attain their ambitions or reach some satisfactory station in life. But they've never encountered difficulty. They have never encountered a besetting hardship. So when they finally encounter real-life challenges to their wants or good goals, they're easily overcome. They've learned to expect that life is fair to them and that life is easy, even if it on certain occasions, it isn't always fair. Have you experienced that?
No.
No? Okay, good. So we're going to look at three phases of suffering, three components that you'll go through, and then we're going to get into some scripture. So point number one is the initial shock. What's happened? How has this happened? You know, did I do something? Could I make this go away? Because I think at first, we don't really understand the depth of the difficulty we're in. On day one of a difficult situation that may go on for years, you have no idea how long it's going to go on. You're still numb from the shock. How could this have happened? Where did it come from? I think maybe another one of the components that we might want to have added to that is that sometimes there's an element of surprise. Sometimes it comes out of nowhere. But also there's a component of beating yourself up. And so imagine maybe you've read some stories of Holocaust survivors or those who didn't survive. You've read some of the narratives, but imagine if you were one of the people that had a chance to flee Poland or to get out of Germany, but you were a little reluctant and then it was too late. If it's not only too late for you, it was too late for your whole family. You had the chance. There was the car trip you could have taken. There was the boat ticket that you could have gotten. You could have gotten out of Dodge before the really bad stuff happened. But you weren't quite sure, and so you sat on the fence for one day too long, and then it was too late. Where does your mind go when you realize that you have not only brought this hardship on yourself, but you've allowed it to come onto your entire family? That's a difficult place to be in. And then who do you blame for that? Because isn't that human nature? And we're going to talk in a little while about the difference between, and this is going to be huge, between human nature and spirit nature. How does my old man, my human nature respond to things? And how does God call on me to respond to things? So what happens when the only thing that you have to rely on is your human wisdom and your human nature, and you realize that you are the cause of what you're experiencing? Where do you turn? Part number two of suffering is when you actually have started to experience this long enough that you realize it isn't going to go away. This isn't, well, the transmission went bad in my truck. I don't know why you were telling me. The transmission went bad in my truck and I don't have the extra $2,000, so it's going to be a chilly walk to work for a little while or whatever. I'm going to have to find... This isn't that kind of thing where I know it's going to go away as soon as I have three more paychecks. And this is... It's starting to settle in that this is going to be years, perhaps, that you'll deal with this. Perhaps you get news that your mate is sick, and sick in a way that you know they're not going to get better, and you're going to have to spend years of your life caring for that person. And not only that, don't we all have a motive to do something difficult if we know there's going to be a happy outcome? But what happens when 10 years are going to be invested in caring for someone only to know you're going to lose them in the end, and it's just going to be 10 years of difficulty and pain, and in the end they'll be gone? And I think this is a really important topic to think about, because in one way or another, all of us are going to go through something like this at some point in life. So my conviction is, if you're not already in this season, it would probably be wise to prepare for this season. Obviously, there's things that we bring on ourselves. There's things we don't bring on ourselves. And while you're going through it, apart from perhaps learning from the mistake, at some point in time, it really doesn't matter any longer who is the cause of this, does it? If you were the guy who said, I think we're going to keep our family here in Germany, and you realized that it was a horrible mistake, once it was too late, it was too late, and there was no point in beating yourself up anymore. So the sooner you get out of the season of self-recrimination, the better. More importantly, though, I think we're going to look at two components of hardship, two reasons for hardship, our beliefs and our commitments. Do you believe in anything strongly enough that if you were assaulted for that, attacked for that, if you had to stand firm in the face of difficulty, is there anything that you believe strongly enough that you would endure suffering for? Or are there any commitments? Are there any relationships? Is there anything in your life that you have vowed to stand with or stand by? And you would be willing to go through suffering because you feel that that commitment is greater than the suffering that you would endure. If you turn over to the back of your page, and this is the first big part. This is part number three. The day that you finally accept, I won't have all the answers. I may never know all the answers. I absolutely don't know when this is going to end. And it seems that I've come to the end of myself. This big bold part, accept full responsibility for your personal care while you acknowledge your condition. You didn't create the condition, but you are completely responsible on a day-to-day basis for your personal care. And if this is a battle of the mind, the only thing that is separating you and the feelings that kept, who was it, Churchill, that wouldn't get a room with a balcony because he was afraid he might jump off? Or Lincoln that toyed with suicide time and again? Here's the big question. Do you live for anything that is bigger than the suffering that you would have to endure? Because both of those men did. It's not that they didn't suffer. As a matter of fact, in their own ways, they probably suffered more greatly than many of us will ever appreciate. It's simply that the purpose that they had to live was larger than anything that could be gained if they gave up. If what you're living for is smaller than the hardship that you might encounter, what's your temptation? Quit. Find the easiest way out. It's why we spend so much time emphasizing purpose. Is your purpose big enough to live for and live through almost anything? Let's turn over to 1 Peter. For those of you who like down-to-earth Bible study, we're actually going to do some of that today. We're going to start in the first chapter of 1 Peter. Now, I know most of you know this, but these letters that Peter writes, he's sending them out to a broad audience. They're going to get circulated around from church community to church community. It's not like he's writing to one specific group of individuals. But he is writing to people that are dealing with some suffering. As a matter of fact, he introduces the letter and says, to those who are elect, in other words, believers, but are in exile. So they've already found themselves in some difficulty. Why? We know that. They're exiles. What is an exile? Someone who's been chased from the home that they chose to live in and had to abandon that home, flee for their lives, flee for their safety, or flee because they thought they were in danger, and so they already find themselves in a bad situation. So he's writing to a group of people who is already acquainted with difficulty. Verse number 3, blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. According to his great mercy, he has caused us to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. To an inheritance that is imperishable, undefiled, and unfading, kept in heaven for you. So he begins by addressing them with this. And here's what he would say if he were to say it in simpler terms. I know your life is difficult. I understand your life is difficult, but never lose sight of this. You have something waiting for you. An inheritance. And he calls it a living hope. That is imperishable and undefiled and unfading. Why would those words be appealing to an exile? What do you know about people who have to run for their lives?
Gives stability, gives consistency to their lives.
When you're fleeing for your life, do you take everything you own? When you're fleeing for your life, you'd be happy just to leave with the shirt on your back and maybe a few choice possessions. When the house is on fire, the question isn't, can we get the spare toys and trinkets out? It's, can we get the kids out? Can we get ourselves out? And if there is time, are there one or two precious things that we would like to get out of the house before it's all gone? So to a group of people who may have abandoned things to be where they are, to a group of people who may not have much, to a group of people who are looking at their lives and saying, what is all of this for? He says, I want to remind you that you have an inheritance. It's imperishable, it's undefiled, and it's unfading. And we're going to look at that. In other words, it's going to last. Don't worry about this. The stuff that you've accumulated in this earth that you really were looking forward to and you wanted to enjoy, the vacation home, the boat, the extra stuff, listen, it all falls apart. You've all experienced, Peter is saying, things that you've lost. Don't worry about this inheritance. It's going to last. It's not going to get corrupted. And it's not going to lose its luster. It's kept for you in heaven, who by God's power are being guarded through faith. So here's the next thing he says. Listen, there's good stuff waiting for you on the other side of this difficulty. But you're probably worried about this fact. You may not live to see the good stuff. We all know the stories of people who saved and dreamed of retirement, right? They were going to do all this cool stuff in retirement. They died 2 days after they retired, and all the stuff that they planned to do, they never get to do. This is what Peter is saying. God is keeping what He has for you safe, but God is also keeping you safe while you wait for what God has for you. And to them, they would have said, "What do you mean keeping me safe? Have you seen my life, God?" And so what Peter is reminding them is that there is an essential component to who they are that is more than just skin and bones. The part of you, Peter says, that really matters, the part of you that is going to be able to appreciate this inheritance, God is guarding that. God is keeping that safe. And in this you rejoice. In other words, he's saying, while you're going through all this difficulty, you need some beacon on the horizon that you can look toward and say, it may last all of this lifetime, but I know what awaits me. There's something good. Because remember what we said? The most miserable place to be in suffering is a place where you lose all hope. Well, there's nothing left to live for, because when you lose all hope, there's nothing left to live for, there's nothing to anticipate. What would be the purpose of further living? So in this you rejoice, though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been grieved by various trials, so that the tested genuineness of your faith, though it is more precious than gold that perishes when tested by fire, may be found to result in the praise and the glory and the honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. So here's what he's saying. In the process of the suffering, something good is going to happen. Your faith is going to be tested. Now, what does he mean by that? Because we hear that kind of phrase all the time. What happens when the house burns down? What happens when the tornado comes to town? What do people always say after they've had a chance to reflect? You know, the annoying news person who still lives in a nice house shoves his microphone in the face of the person who just lost everything. And what does the family usually say if they've had time to collect their thoughts? Huh?
Get lost.
Well, okay, that's what he says off camera. Get lost.
Yeah, at least we're not alive, our family is safe.
Right. At the point of hardship, you start to really understand the difference between the things that are important and the things that aren't. When everything is going well, do you appreciate that? I mean, everybody says, oh, family is really important. But how many people who have it all really understand what they've just said? Let's read this again. In this you rejoice, though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been grieved by various trials, so that the tested genuineness of your faith, more precious than gold, that perishes, though tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Now, we always think about God getting glory and honor, but who is this praise and honor directed at? Who is Peter saying is going to receive some honor after they've been tested? Don't look at me, it's in the text, really. So we are. And what he's saying, and we're going to look at this in a little bit more detail in just a few minutes. But what he's saying is, guys, you have been invited to be warriors in the same way that Christ was. And in the same way that Christ suffered, but he suffered nobly and he suffered righteously, and in the end, greater honor was given to him. You, if you suffer nobly and honorably for the right things in the right ways, there's a degree of honor and dignity that awaits you at the end. And you and Christ are brothers. And if you'd like to picture it this way, have you ever seen soldiers get together? I'm not a vet, but have you ever seen soldiers get together, even if they are from different generations, have fought in different wars, and they talk, and even though their stories are different, there's a lot that's similar. And so Peter is picturing this kind of a scene where All those who have suffered, all those who have fought valiantly and nobly in whatever the situation that God placed them, they're going to be able to share their stories one day. Though you have not seen Him, you love Him. Though you do not now see Him, you believe in Him and rejoice with joy that is inexpressible and filled with glory. Let me just find where it is. So, second side of your page, which I guess you're on near the bottom, there is a certain level and quality of relationship with God which is based on shared journey and learned trust. It can happen only as we travel in the same direction and with the same purpose. And immediately above that are a couple of bullet points. To obey God for the blessing is one level of maturity. Here's what I mean by that. It's better to obey God than not to obey God. Do we agree on that?
Yes.
The question is, why are you obeying God? Are you obeying God because you hope to get something out of it? Or are you obeying God because you simply love God and you're going to do what He asks because you're tight, you're together, you're family? Because a tested faith, a tested life experience is one that starts to follow not because of what you can get out of something, but because of the experience of relationship. And I know we talk so often about relationship, but this is it. The testing here, the stripping away, the burning off of the dross is all about determining why is it that you are claim that you are in love with God? Why is it that you claim that you want fellowship and relationship with God? Is it all about the hopes that if you're in the right connection with God that you'll get the right stuff for your life? Or are you gradually maturing to the point that you don't care if there is bad stuff that comes into your life? I mean, you'd rather it didn't, but if it does, it does, so be it. Let the chips fall where they may. I have made a commitment to be in this covenant relationship with God, and no matter what happens, I will walk in this direction and walk this way. Consequences be damned. I don't know if I was allowed to say that, but it's too late. Can't reel it back. All right, let's jump down now to verse 13. So Peter has already told them to steel themselves and focus their vision on the future. Yeah, there's going to be some difficult times right now. I want you to focus your vision on the future. But we still have a question. And the question is this. Okay, that's great. So 30 years from now, I'm going to get all this stuff. When my earth suit and my spirit man separate, I'm going to get this stuff. But what happens between now and then? Don't we all want to know that? Okay, that's great. 30, 40 years from now, I'm going to die. I'm going to go to heaven. Everything's going to be wonderful. But how in the world how do I live today? How do I get through tomorrow? Verse 13. Therefore, preparing your minds for action and being sober-minded, set your hope fully on the grace that will be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Three things. Prepare your mind for action. You might want to underline that if you have a real Bible. If you have an imitation Bible, then I guess, well, whatever you do in that, they'll have to do that. What does it mean to prepare your mind for action? Remember we said the battle is all in the mind. One of the tendencies that we have when we are suffering is just to lay down, crawl up in a fetal position, and hope it all goes away. If you're in a fight, it's not going to go away. A good enemy, a worthy enemy, is not going to just ignore you if you play possum. The enemy wants you out of the picture. So the sooner you accept the fact that you have enemies, here's the thing. You have enemies no matter who you are and where you are. Are you simply a man of flesh? You've never been born again? You still have enemies. The unfortunate truth is one of the biggest enemies you have when you're simply a man of flesh is you are your own enemy. I know that's not something you want to hear, but you're your own enemy. The day you say, I do to God, you just acquire different enemies. Your entire life, you're going to have enemies. And so every morning, you better prepare your mind for action. And you better expect to move. And being sober-minded. Well, what does that mean? Does that mean you go around all morbid? This is the group interaction part. I mean, yes, I can talk. Believe me, I have the lungs. I can talk all morning. I'd prefer not to, but I can. Don't make me do that. Thanks. Okay. It doesn't mean that we go around all down in the mouth, but here's what it does mean. That we assess the facts and take life seriously. Yeah. This isn't a dress rehearsal for something that's going to come along afterwards. This is your one and only chance to make a difference here. And so every morning you wake up and you will prepare your mind for action for the day. When I say morning, maybe for you it's evening. Maybe that's when you do your preparing. And I'm not just saying, well, you need to read the Bible and pray. I'm saying you assess your situation. You look carefully and discerningly and pray for specific wisdom as it applies to living through the difficulty that you're living through right here and now. Set your hope fully in the grace that will be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. It's relationship again. As obedient children, do not be conformed to the passions of your former ignorance. What does that mean? In light of suffering. There's at least three things that the man of flesh will do at a time of suffering. When things are difficult, when things are coming at you that you don't know how to deal with, what's one of the most logical things that a guy would do? Huh?
Revert back.
All right, so Mike is saying turn back. All right, here's what I'm going to say. What do we say that animals do? When a threat comes to an animal, what does it do? There's three things. We usually say fight or flight, but there's fight, flight, and stand dead still. If you can't run from it, you hide from it. And honestly, that is exactly what I... Here, we'll just write it. Tell me that one of those doesn't represent the way you would be tempted to deal with suffering. Here's what he's saying. Don't be conformed any longer to the way that your man of flesh would approach suffering. He would try to avoid it. He would try to run from it. Or he would fight it. Even when he fought it, he would fight it in a dishonorable way. But as he who called you is holy, you also be holy in your conduct. All right, so here's the thing. Remember we said that one of the questions that everybody asks when they're suffering is why? Don't most of us know that you may not get a clear answer as to why? So if you will never ultimately understand, or you may not understand the reason for your suffering, and if this is a battle of the mind, here's another alternative. What if you brought meaning and purpose to the suffering by the way you engage the suffering? What if rather than ask the question, why am I going through this, you said to yourself, if I have to go through this, I may as well go through it with honor and dignity and purpose so that I bring honor and glory to God in this. If I'm going to suffer, if I'm going to be miserable anyway, I may as well be miserable in a way that's good for something. Instead of trying to run from it, avoid it, curl up and hide from it. What's that?
I said that is so difficult. I'm going to be in a good spirit and to actually shine that light. Because the misery of the situation sometimes becomes so big, so molding, that's what you're thinking about. You know?
Hold that thought. Now what do I do? What do I do? I now again go back to the what we just read. I prepare my mind for action. How many times a day do you have to prepare your mind for action? As many times as you're tempted to respond one of these three ways in the flesh, you have to re-prepare your mind for action. Honestly, that may be once every 15 minutes. Seriously. And the more good stuff that is in you before this comes, the more you'll have to draw on in the moment. The less good stuff that is in you, the more time you're going to have to literally spend not fighting the fight, but in retreat and trying to get alone so that you can discover what you need to put in you. This is why training is so important. What?
I'm glad you said that. Yeah. It's like you're out there running in your marathon. Well, I knew I should have trained a little more. I knew I should have ran a few more miles. Yeah.
All right, we move on. You shall be holy, for I am holy. And if you call on him as Father who judges impartially according to each one's deeds, conduct yourself with fear throughout the time of your exile. And he said, you are exiles, and he addresses them as exiles. But I want you to see how he twists this now. And he's moved from saying, listen, I know you've left your home, and you've had to move to this other area. But as uncomfortable as this may be for you to look at, I'd like you to change your frame of mind. Instead of thinking about, boy, I can't wait to get home, why don't you just start to look at your whole life here as a life in exile? Because ultimately, this is not your home anyway, so why don't you just readjust your focus? Instead of pining and longing and making yourself miserable because you can't get back to where you used to live, why don't you just accept the fact that wherever you live on earth, this is not your ultimate home, so no matter where you are in exile. Because what happens when we are at home? Home is the place we go to get comfortable. Is it not? But if you're constantly reminded you're not home, then you ultimately never let your guard down and you never relax. If you're actually in a battle, do you ever want to relax? So long as you are in the war, do you ever want to relax? Do you ever want to let your guard down? It might be dangerous. Knowing that you were ransomed from the futile ways inherited from your forefathers, not with perishable things such as silver or gold, but with the precious blood of Christ, like that of a lamb without blemish or spot. And so here's what he reminds them of. And it's motive. Force of habit, Ron. I'm erasing the board. I don't even think I'm going to write anything profound up here now. I just erased it. But it was good of you to pay attention. Here's what he's saying. You've been called. You've been chosen. You are a warrior. And you haven't been chosen just because God was desperate and so he paid a few bucks and hired you as a mercenary. Do you know how you became a warrior in the kingdom? Look at what it says. You've been ransomed from this futile way of life, not with perishable things such as silver or gold. In other words, when God needed a man for the kingdom, he didn't take a few shekels out of his bag of money, go down the road and hire a mercenary. He laid down his own life as an example for us. He said, you are so precious to me, and I would so much like to have you part of this fight that I am willing to lay down my life. I am willing to do whatever it takes to have you be a part of this. So when you're tempted to quit, remember the cost of what it cost to get you to be in this kingdom. I know I butchered the wording of that horribly. I apologize for that. But do you understand what I'm saying? You are who you are and where you are if you are a man of the Spirit because someone laid down their life for you. You are cherished and honored son of God. Don't you dare give up the fight in the middle of it. All right, now I'm starting to sound like I'm preaching. Sorry, I'll throttle it down a little bit. Let's turn over to 2 Timothy. We'll start at the beginning of chapter 3. Just so we set the stage, so that we see that Paul is talking about the same things. So while Peter is talking to a group of people, and honestly, Peter is writing to people, many of whom he's probably never met, And he doesn't know the extent to which that letter will travel, so he has no idea all the people who will get those words. Paul, on the other hand, is directing his comments to one individual. And so this is like a seasoned veteran talking to somebody who's a little bit less seasoned but thoroughly committed. Wouldn't you, in the midst of the most difficult time that you were going to face, wouldn't you love to have someone who has gone through that and could tell you the best advice that they had about what to do in that? And this is exactly what's happening here. It says, but understand this, that in the last days there will come times of difficulty. And then he goes on to describe the times of difficulty. Now jump down to verse 10. You, however, have followed my teaching, my conduct, my aim in life, my faith, my patience, my love, my steadfastness, my persecutions and sufferings that happened to me. All right, so now that we've read the list, let's back up. You followed my teaching, Timothy. When you're going through a difficult time, what is the knowledge that you need to know? What are the facts that you need to know and the way that that will help you to interpret life? Tim, you followed my teaching. Good teaching is in you. What are you exposing yourself to? What you expose yourself to, this is a big thing. Life is really not what happens to you. Life is really how you interpret what happens to you. We've all heard that. How do I interpret what happens to me? That's a serious question. What are the things in me that allow me to interpret what has happened to me? They're the things that I've put into me already. I interpret what is happening to me based on what is already in me that gives me the understanding to look at something and discern what it is. So my interpretive abilities are no better than what is already in me. Do you understand me? If there's junk in me, my interpretation of the situation is going to be garbage. If you want to have better interpretive skills, what this means to me, what I could do with it, how I could respond to that, if you want to have better interpretive skills, you need to have better knowledge inside of you. It's all in the mind. But Tim, you've not only watched and listened to my teaching, but also my conduct. How I've behaved through all this. You know, last night I was reading through this, and I don't know why, maybe it's not the first time I've had this thought, but it just really struck me. I think I understand why God chose Paul. Right, and we look at Paul, and Paul's a great scholar. He knew the Word. So he would know how to teach the word as it related to this Messiah. He would know all that. But why else might God have chosen Paul? See, Paul was the persecutor. Paul was the guy who brought the storm to other people's lives. Paul was the guy who brought death or whippings or floggings to other people's lives. Who better to understand the mind of the person inflicting punishment than one who has already inflicted punishment in the past? So when Paul is himself being whipped and beaten and stoned, persecuted, chased from town to town, and remember, not all suffering is physical, some is mental. The mental anguish, the emotional anguish. I've been rejected again. My message has been rejected again. I got to find another place to teach. I got to find another place just to hide right now until I can collect my thoughts and move on. But he'd already experienced this from the other side. He'd been the one with the bowl and the dish dishing it out for years. And so now he has a way to understand the mind of the people who are inflicting the pain on him. And so he says to Timothy, you've watched my conduct. This is motive for each of us. As you go through suffering, know that there's people watching you. You didn't choose that. You didn't want that. Frankly, I would rather people didn't watch me when I was suffering because I don't always do it with nobility. And you should wipe that ridiculous smirk off your face right now because you don't always do it well either.
That's the beauty of being real brothers.
So I don't really want people watching me and mimicking me while I'm going through suffering. I suspect that the world looks a little bit the way it does because there's already too many people who didn't suffer nobly and there's people that have watched them. And they've learned how to encounter suffering or how to deal with suffering based on that. But what he's saying is, people are looking. Tim, you've watched my conduct. Here's another big one. You've also watched my aim in life. What is that? How would we re-say that?
Purpose.
Yeah. You know what my purpose is. So you know that I'm not a fool. I don't rush into the next town looking to get beaten because I like pain. You know that there is a good mission that I am on, and I am willing to endure the pain because the purpose is more important than the pain. You've seen my faith. Isn't it good to have someone that you can walk with during this? Remember when you said, well, how do I do this? 15 minutes later, I'm back in this funk, and I feel this way. Isn't it good to have someone that you can journey with in the difficult times? I want to be around people that are like this. There aren't that many. You know, this is rare to find a person who is willing to suffer honorably and nobly. My patience, my love, my steadfastness. This is exactly the opposite of what we had written on the board. Patient, love, and steadfast. What do we see? Run, fight, or hide? That doesn't look at all like these. The man of flesh is going to run or fight or hide. The man of the spirit is going to stand patiently in this. He's still going to love people. Where does that come from? Where does the ability to love someone who is persecuting you come from? I'll guarantee it doesn't come from my man of flesh. I would have to use words that I am not allowed to use here in order to describe what my man of flesh would like to do at times of suffering. And so would you, incidentally. So we won't talk about that. Let's turn back over to 1 Peter 2, I think. So you're probably wondering why we're doing all this, and I hope that, you know, the question is, what do I do at a time of suffering? And this is a minute-by-minute, day-by-day model of these are the steps that you need to take. Prepare your mind for action. Be serious about it. Remember what's out there waiting for you, that this fight is not going to go on forever. Remember that this is not your home. Don't get totally comfortable in it. Don't get relaxed in it. Don't build all of your hopes and expectations for here and now. You'll be disappointed. Have a purpose to live for that is bigger than what you have to endure. And if you don't already have that, start to find one. The scripture says that each of us has been given, essentially, and I'm re-paraphrasing this here, each of us has been given an important mission in life. Figure it out. Because if you don't know what your mission is, then maybe your life doesn't matter. And if your life doesn't matter, your suffering needs to be avoided. Yes, Scott. Yeah.
And I think sometimes we go through life so blinded with our suffering that we miss the opportunity to realize what our purpose is. And as you're kind of talking about this, I'm kind of thinking that, you know, if we kind of scrape off all the resentment, all the anger, everything that we're, you know, the despair, whatever it is, and we have the joy in our heart all the time, even through the difficult times, we'll probably see more opportunities to identify what our true purpose is. And if we had that understanding of what our purpose is, then it spins back to being able to better deal with the difficult times and the suffering.
Do you remember during the spiritual coaching series we talked a lot about how each of us is born and we have a component of the lie in us, and that one of the jobs that we have is to train out the lie? Yeah. That we all go through life with a certain component of the lie of this world built into us. We were raised with it. Even if we were raised by believing parents, the culture around us, and we weren't raised by perfect parents. Randall, I'm sorry, you weren't a perfect parent. I'm sure you were a good parent, but you weren't a perfect parent. Lord knows I was not a perfect parent. I feel really bad for my kids some days. But We were all born with some of that in us. One of the things that I think is a lie that at least today we have embraced is that one of our reasons for being here is to find personal satisfaction and enjoyment. Now, I'm not saying that satisfaction and enjoyment isn't really cool. But what if from birth you were taught this belief? You are here for a mission and a purpose that is larger than you, and no matter what happens, you stay focused on that mission and purpose. I don't care if there's pain. I don't care if there's difficulty. I don't care if you see everyone around you seeming to eat nothing but cake and be happy. I don't care what they do. I want you to live for this mission. What if that's the way you were raised from day one? Would you have a different outlook on life? Then getting to the point where you're 35 years old and starting to think maybe there's more to life than my own happiness, because at the end of the day, the more I get, the more I want. So, and that's the self-defeating cycle of it, right? We always think that one more will make us happy, and when we get to one more, we'll finally be content. And what do we discover when we get to one more? There's never enough, and there's 10 more on the other side, and so we've established this law of diminishing return. We don't want to don't have anywhere near enough to survive. Wanting more is a legitimate concern. When I get to a point that my basic needs are want and I should be able to experience contentment, but I continue to want, then that the more that I want, that I go from not having enough where my life is miserable to I get to the point where I have what it would take to be reasonably content. And then from that point on, my quest for more and more is just a downward slope again. But if we live that way, then we've missed the whole reason for our being here. All right, does anybody remember what I was going to do next? Let's see. All right, let's go to verse 20 of 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 20. For what credit is it if when you sin you are beaten and you endure it? But if when you do good and suffer for it, you endure, this is a gracious thing in the sight of God. What did we say was one of our first questions that we ask as soon as we get past the why when it comes to suffering? It's, where's God in this? Why didn't God do something to keep me out of this? What's being said here? But if when you do good and suffer for it and you endure, this is a gracious thing in the sight of God. That your honorable and noble suffering on purpose is something that God is pleased by. And because He subjected His own Son to that and considered that right for His own Son to be made pure and right through suffering, what is He saying when He allows us to suffer? What is God really saying when He allows us to suffer? We say, apparently God doesn't love me if He allows me to suffer. What's God's perspective on this?
Trying your endurance, your patience.
Saying, let me tell you how much I love you. I love you enough to have your character built up in this way because I think that much of you and I believe that much in you. What's that?
So that is so other than the normal way we think or imagine possibly going on. Don't automatically find God having to align with happiness. There's so other than the way that the adult process just goes.
Of course it is. It's why every morning I have to condition my mind. Because every day I'm going to be attacked. Listen, even if we get the good stuff in us and we get the lie out of us, the lie lives all around us. And so every day from 360 degrees, we are being bombarded by a message that says, run from the difficulty, get out of the difficulty, do whatever you can. It's certainly not stand up in the midst of the difficulty and bring meaning to it.
That's why Romans says, don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of our mind. This is exactly it.
We'll live under the lie, too, that if we become Christians, our life should be good by the world's standards. 2 Timothy 3:12 says, in fact, everyone who wants to live a godly life will be burned.
We don't read that verse.
I'm sitting here feeling it, I'm not going to make it. And so I said to him, what is it that you really need? He didn't ask for an iPad or a laptop. Even better shelter conditions. He asked for kerosene to stay warm and help finding a job. And is that what you talk about being alert, having being alert and having a sober mind? That is that without God, I would be this man. And maybe even with God, I may find myself in these circumstances. What is it that I really need versus all the things I have or just plain old want? And my wife will always ask me, do you need that or do you want it? I try to discern because I think I need some things I want. And that idea of the genuineness of faith just played out in what we're willing to sacrifice for others, not what we're willing to sacrifice for ourselves. It's easy for me. I would sell my iPad in a heartbeat for my children. I'm not so sure I would do it for someone on the streets. I would come up with excuses. That's why I said, when you're being honest as a leader, it's not that I'm smiling or smirking. It's that I'm filled with joy, because that's not the commonality among men in our communities. So when somebody is honest about weakness...
This is hard. I mean, let's just be blunt about it. This is not easy to live in this way. And frankly, as a point of encouragement, to get it right one day out of seven, I think, is a major accomplishment sometimes. Right? To have the right attitude in the right time in the right place, just a portion of the time is great. And so if you're struggling to have the right attitude at all, don't be discouraged and give up. You know, at least you're aware of the fact now that you don't maybe even have the right attitude. Was there a time when you didn't even care if you had the right attitude? So that's step one. First Peter 3:8. We're going to wrap this up. Finally, all of you have unity of mind, sympathy, brotherly love, a tender heart, and a humble mind. Now, we've got to call attention again to who Peter is writing to. So he's writing to groups of believers that would have been in these little enclaves, and they would have passed this letter on from one group to the next, but these believers in general would have traveled around. And undoubtedly, as they watched people in the community, they would have discerned, this guy lives in a different way. He's probably a believer. And they would have then demonstrated kindness and sympathy toward them. What is our first response when we encounter strangers?
Just gotta order a car.
Huh?
Just an automatic car coming back to the society that we're in, just in general, where we're going to space. And within like that first few minutes is that judgment, and then it's right there.
Right.
Keep moving, it's no eye contact. You know?
Do I ever get to experience people if I always have that guard up?
No, not really.
And so he's saying, in the community sense, in the social sense, you might have to drop your guard a little bit. But then he's saying, in the closer community of Christian fellowship, you're not going to be able to do this alone. Have unity of mind, sympathy, brotherly love, a tender heart, and a humble mind. Now, I know this might surprise you, but even in the church, sometimes we look at people who are going through a tough time and we just look at somebody else and you say, would you just suck it up and get on with it? Now, I mean, maybe that's called for at times. That might be speaking the truth in love, and sometimes people need that. But do you remember how we started this and we said that we don't all suffer in the same way because we're not all at the same point? That a 14-year-old's definition of suffering is different than a 35-year-old's definition. Right? That a person in the United States' definition of suffering might be different than a person who's a refugee that just crossed the border into Syria, right? That we all have different levels or thresholds of suffering. So when I look at somebody else and I don't know anything about what's going on inside them, and I don't know anything about their past, and I just look at them, from my age, from my experience, having at least had a few difficult times in life, and I say, would you just suck it up and get on with it? Which is my first tendency, and my second tendency, and usually my third tendency too. What are we saying? I'm saying that everybody needs to be at the same level that I am, have had the same experiences that I have. And yet, here's the reality. Somewhere in the world, there's people looking at me and saying, would you just suck it up and stop acting like a baby and man up and get on with your life? And there are. So finally, we need to have, I guess, an accepting spirit of each other. We need to come together to bring this to each other. Here's my point. You cannot suffer alone and do it well. You can suffer for a purpose. You can bring purpose to your suffering. You can bring honor and glory to God in the midst of your suffering. You can do this knowing that you have something awaiting you, including an honor and a glory that will come to you through that suffering. But you can't do this alone and do it well. In the end, we need each other to support each other. And that's my final statement. If you try to go through this life alone, let me just close it like this. If you try to go through this life alone, you're a fool or worse. And there was a time in my life where I would have preferred to go through life alone. But I've just learned over the years that it works better in community. All right.